Plan B for BP.
The oil company could be in really bad shape.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, July 6th. The British government has reportedly become increasingly concerned that British oil giant BP could collapse.
Sumo wrestlers gamble and it does not pay off. And the library bets on a bright idea. Location, location, location. But first,
the Times of London reports the UK government is drawing up backup plans in the event BP is taken over or sold off in pieces. From London, Stephen Beard has more.
If BP collapsed, it could have a massive impact on the UK as a whole. The company employs 10,000 people here, and it pays $8 billion a year in tax. Before the Gulf of Mexico spill, it was Britain's biggest company, and is still a major component in many British pension plans. But there are deeper strategic reasons for the British government to be worried about the company. BP controls a vast network of pipelines linking oil and gas fields in the North Sea. Nick McGregor analyses the oil industry for brokers Redmayne Bentley.
Ultimately, BP control the landing infrastructure for a large amount of the North Sea's oil, so other operators can't get their oil onshore without BP's pipelines.
The British government refuses to comment on whether it's preparing for the collapse of BP. The company dismissed the report, saying, "We will recover." In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
For more now, we turn to Julie Neiman with Smith Moore in St. Louis. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Stacey.
BP is a huge company. How serious would that be?
There's not a chance BP will fail for one major reason. Fabulous properties. They're going to be getting investments from everybody. They're shopping China, Singapore, the Middle East, Libya. They all want to take positions in it. Mm-hmm. Last week, they were even talking to Exxon. So BP basically is going to be scrambling to get money to help them do the cleanup and to stabilize their park, finances short term. But you will see management walk the plank. Somebody must be sacrificed here.
Julie Neiman in St. Louis. Thank you, Julie.
You bet.
The Washington Post reports BP has cleaned up less than two-thirds of what it had assured federal regulators it could remove in a single day. The newspaper reports it made that promise a month before the disaster. Kimberly Kindy wrote the story for The Washington Post. She's with us live from D.C. Kimberly, good morning.
Hi.
Give us an idea of how much BP overestimated what they could clean up there.
Well, they said they would be able to skim, and that's just skimming alone, over 490,000 barrels a day. And what we're looking at really is closer to about 3,000 barrels a day.
And how did they get that? I mean, that's huge. How did they get it so wrong? Was this malfeasance? Was it, just incompetency? What was it?
Well, they're not answering any questions about their numbers right now. I've asked them. I showed them my math. The truth is, though, this number was really created in isolation without they didn't go to the company that was going to do the cleanup for them and say, hey, do these numbers square? Can you do this? The federal government didn't challenge them on those numbers at all, didn't ask them to prove they could arrive at those goals.
This is the MMS, right? The Minerals Management Service.
Mineral Management Service, right. Absolutely. So you have them not consulting with the people who they're counting on to do the cleanup to see if the numbers were accurate, and then the federal government, MMS, not asking them, how'd you come up with these numbers? They were thrown into a report in isolation without anybody, it appears, looking at them and definitely not challenging them.
And what could result from this overestimate? I mean, does this mean more lawsuits in the future?
Well, there's a lawsuit already just over these numbers. Earth Justice, Sierra Club, some other groups, Gulf Restoration Network. Whether there'll be more, I don't know. I mean, it definitely continues to put pressure on this effort to reform things. Plans for something this serious, this kind of disaster, They need to be checked and challenged, and they're really looking at there are all kinds of panels that are being put together right now looking at what needs to be done differently. Congress is looking at that. And this, a plan that really reflects reality is something that there's great push for so that the next, if a disaster of this magnitude happens again, they've got a plan that checks with reality.
And very quickly, Kimberly, any plans to ramp up the cleanup down there?
Well, right now, they have this thing called the Whale out there that they're testing. It's a Taiwanese skimmer, 10 stories high. It's gigantic. They're hoping that it can skim as much as 50,000 barrels a day, and that would be a phenomenal change from the 3,000 they're doing right now.
But still just a percentage, a mere percentage of what they had originally anticipated, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Kimberly Kendi from The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, July 6th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visits Washington today. A controversy over Jewish settlements in the West Bank and the blockade of Gaza are likely to dominate the agenda there. One thing that probably won't: Israel's economy. Brett Neely reports.
Israel's troubles appear to have had almost no economic impact. At 7%, unemployment there is lower than in the U.S., and the financial crisis never touched Israeli banks. Glenn Yago is an economist at the Milken Institute. He says the country's foreign policy turmoil has even helped develop the economy.
The demand for solutions to what were battlefield technologies are easily transferring into civilian uses.
He says that sort of innovation has also transformed agriculture, which was Israel's first big export industry.
It's also not selling tomatoes, but selling tomato seeds and new variants, new seed technologies that increase productivity in agriculture outside of Israel.
The country's thriving export sector sent almost $19 billion worth of goods to the U.S. last year, twice what we sent to Israel. Yago adds that while Gaza gets all the attention these days, the relatively peaceful Palestinian-controlled West Bank is also experiencing an economic boom. A bit of good news in a part of the world that needs it. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
We thought we'd test our knowledge of international affairs yet again, as we do every so often. And we're glad to bring in Stefan Richter with this morning's Marketplace Globalist Quiz. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Steve. Are you ready for today's quiz?
I am ready. Let's get it done.
Which of the following major economies will have to adjust the most in terms of its budget to get back to a sustainable debt level? Italy, Spain, the United Kingdom, or United States?
I'm going to guess the United States.
You are so right. And the bad news for the United States is that it needs to adjust its budget almost as much as Greece, which is the laughing stock. Between now and 2020, about 12% need to be cut out of our budget in order to get back to that sustainable level by 2020, which is considered like 60%.
Part of the stimulus, obviously, but also the debt going back many, many years here in this country, Stefan.
And the bottom falling out of the economy with no tax revenues at the state and local levels. And I guess the only good news is that other countries have a hard time, too. The new government in the UK will need to correct its budget balances by about 9%. The Japanese have even a harder job. They need to cut 13%. But that shows us that the pain is quite evenly spread around the globe. And wherever this financial crisis came from, we're all going to carry its consequences for quite some time to come.
And not a whole lot of cheery information. Stefan Richter, thank you for...
I'm sorry about that today, but I'll try to be more sunny next time.
Well, we'll hope so. All right, Stefan Richter joining us this morning. Stefan Richter, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stefan Richter is the publisher and editor-in-chief of TheGlobalist.com, the daily online magazine on the global economy, politics, and culture.
Listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, July 6th. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Forget rain and sleet. Red ink is giving the Postal Service big problems. The post office is holding a briefing today. It says it needs to raise its rates because it's been losing so much money. It also wants to eliminate Saturday delivery. Our own Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us live from Washington, D.C. to talk about this with us. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
Nancy, what is the case that the post office is making for this?
Well, how about a nearly $4 billion loss last fiscal year? Is that good enough for you, Stacey?
That's pretty compelling, yeah.
That's pretty good. Postal officials are going to talk about that at the briefing today. They're also going to try to make the case for a rate increase. And they say the price of a first-class stamp hasn't gone up since last year. It's still 44 cents. Now, as I mentioned, the Postal Service is losing money. That's due to competition from delivery services like FedEx. Plus, of course, more people are emailing instead of sending letters. And the post office says it's already done its share of cost cutting. It's eliminated 40,000 full-time jobs.
How would the rate hikes and the loss of Saturday delivery impact the businesses that rely on the Postal Service?
Well, there have been howls of protest from some companies, but others say they can live with it. The CEO of Hallmark told the New York Times the Postal Service would lose business if it raised prices and stopped delivering mail on Saturdays. But then you have the top guy at Netflix saying, hey, he can live with mail delivery just 5 days a week. Just don't raise prices. And then there's a group of businesses and charities called the Affordable Mail Alliance. And they say if they have to pay more to send out ads and letters, they'll have to cut jobs to make ends meet.
So what happens now?
Well, the request for a rate increase will go to the Postal Regulatory Commission, and that commission starts hearings on the increase request next week. Congress would have to approve the elimination of Saturday mail delivery, and so far there doesn't seem to be much support on Capitol Hill for that. Some members of Congress say the post office should actually promote its Saturday delivery to compete more with companies like FedEx and UPS.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Nancy.
You're welcome.
While the number of packages going through the mail is down, the number of people traveling around the country is up. AAA says travel was up 15% this past holiday weekend. That meant lots of full airplanes and probably lots of overbooked flights. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports federal regulators want to clamp down on the airline's practice of bumping passengers to a later flight.
Frequent flyer Andrea Valdez has been bumped 9 times.
I consider myself a bit lucky when that happens.
She gets a voucher for a few $100 and even kudos from the flight staff.
Oh my God, we're so thankful.
They should be. If Valdez didn't raise her hand, they'd have to force someone off the plane and pay them up to $800 cash by law.
No, I didn't know that.
Most flyers don't. The Department of Transportation wants to make compensation rules more clear and raise the fee for involuntary bumps to about $1,300. George Hobica runs airfarewatchdog.com. He says that increase now keeps pace with inflation, and it's also a slap on the wrist.
I think what the DOT is trying to say to the airlines is, let's make it more painful for you to bump, and let's do it less.
Hobica says DOT also aims to get airlines to add more flights. They've been holding out because it's cheaper to hand out vouchers than fly with empty seats. DOT's proposal is open for public comment until August 6th. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Steve Chiatakis. In Japan, a sumo wrestling tournament due to start this Sunday won't be broadcast on Japanese television. That's because of a scandal over illegal gambling by wrestlers. It's the first time a tournament will not be televised live for more than half a century. From Tokyo, the BBC's Roland Burke reports for Marketplace.
Sumo has its origins in the Shinto religion, and wrestlers are supposed to display moral strength, as well as raw power in the ring. But Japanese sport has been scandalized by an illegal gambling racket, some of it organized by gangster middlemen. Now Japan's public broadcaster has cancelled its live coverage of the Nagoya tournament after receiving thousands of calls and emails from angry sumo fans. NHK's president, Shigeo Fukuchi, said the sport was facing a once-in-a-century crisis.
The baseball gambling scandal affects the core of sumo, and a link with an antisocial group such as Japanese crime syndicates has been pointed out. We find the issue extremely serious and deplorable.
The top-ranked Japanese wrestler, Kota Mitsuki, was banned from the sport at the weekend after admitting placing bets on baseball. And more than a dozen others have been suspended. Sumo had already been damaged when crime bosses were given front-row seats to a tournament last year. They'd wanted to be visible in television coverage to cheer up fellow gangsters watching in their prison cells. In Tokyo, I'm the BBC's Roland Burke for Marketplace.
Thinking about going back to school? Consider this, a master's degree in gelato making. Megan Williams has more from Bologna, Italy.
Group six is vanilla, hazelnut, and coffee.
Not every college has flavors as core subjects, but then few are called the Gelato University. Run by the Carpigiani Gelato Making Machine Company in Bologna, Italy. The so-called university attracts hundreds of international students a year, here to study the fine art of preparing this frozen delight.
Ready? Okay, here it goes.
Steve McAllister from Boston keeps a close watch over his first batch of hazelnut gelato as it oozes out of a stainless steel machine.
What are you doing here?
Well, I'm having a midlife crisis, and I work as a fundraiser, and I've started to think, well, a few years from now, when I burn out, I have been wondering about what I would be doing. So I thought I would do something else that I like, eat ice cream, and in this case, make ice cream.
Gelato has 30% less fat than regular ice cream, and that appeals to an increasingly health-conscious America. So says Luciano Ferrari. He's the head prof of the English language gelato course.
Frozen dessert technologist. That's my title, if you will.
And in Italian, how do you say that?
Gelatiere.
That sounds better in Italian.
Ferrari says gelato sales worldwide are rising slowly but steadily. Since the recession, though, gelato's low cost and low fat has made it a popular treat and an appealing business. Enrollment in the English language course this year is up by about 50% compared to past years.
From all those people who see their job in some kind of danger or that want to, you know, have a backup plan. Because at the end of the day, we've seen that the consumption of frozen dessert in general and of gelato in particular has gone up during the last few years.
It's good business for Carpigiani gelato machines as well. About 20% of students taking the course end up buying the machines to start their gelaterias. Talk about a sweet, soft sell. In Bologna, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
And finally, the American Library Association says libraries are putting more branches in consumer-friendly places. They're smaller, they don't need as many staffers, and they offer do-it-yourself convenience.
Branches have popped up in cafes, grocery stores, some have drive-through windows. Dozens now are even operating in shopping malls, a quiet respite from the hustle and bustle.
So the next time you want to check out some Shakespeare, you can slurp on an orange Julius. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.